Hello, I'm Anna Serene, and you're listening to Berlinale's House of Talents.
Wes's process is, I always think of him as an additive director. You know, he's constantly adding detail all the way through the process, I believe right into editing and post-production.
Wes had said always it's in the style of the 60s and 70s, but in the future. So do something with that.
He likes to push the boundaries. He wants his stop-frame movies to have the same feel as his live-action movies. You know, sometimes I would say to him, you know, actually, physics tells us that we can't do this. And he always says, just show me what you can do.
At Talents, we like to take the time to understand the how and why of filmmaking. Today, we take you closer to the people and crafts behind Wes Anderson's visionary cinema. An exacting and detail-obsessed director, Anderson has directed more than 10 feature films, most notably Grand Budapest Hotel and Isle of Dogs. Both films opened the Berlinale in 2014 and 2018 respectively, and the latter won him a Silver Bear as Best Director. His most recent feature, The French Dispatch, is due to be screened at Cannes this summer. But beyond the man himself, the work of this genius is served by an array of talented professionals, some of whom have been guests at Berlinale Talents. With them, we can delve into his live action and animated features to explore questions of storyboarding, prop making and cinematography in the company of moderator Andrew Amundsen. We begin with storyboarder extraordinaire Jay Clark, who tells us about this visual workflow behind the stop-motion animation Isle of Dogs. Japanese art was a constant source of inspiration, and Jay here talks about woodblock prints and Akira Kurosawa's emblematic camera movements, both of which were essential to his storyboarding practice.
You know, when Wes first got in touch about Isle of Dogs, he said that Kurosawa was going to be the real, you know, driving influence, but specifically early Kurosawa, because everyone's sort of aware of those, the Seven Samurai and the later films, but there's this whole sort of back history of Kurosawa, which we were able to just jump into and really spend time with a master of cinema. So that's my plan. We will spend time with a master of cinema, and I'll somehow show you how that fed into Isle of Dogs. First off, was this idea. It's crazy to think this was back in 2017, but one of the main influences were Japanese woodblock prints. Wes said if somehow the animatic and the storyboards could look like Japanese woodblock prints. So I went to the V&A and really studied the line work and just the characters and the settings. And already I could see if this is going to be this world with the world of stop motion. You could kind of get an idea of what this weird fusion was going to be. They're inherently cinematic anyway. They're kind of almost like camera moves, you know, the way the eye is drawn down to that whirlpool of activity. And I was struck by the fact that, you know, Wes Anderson is very much known for how he moves the camera in a particular way. And so comparing that, the Japanese woodblock prints, with how he moves the camera. So these are a few examples of storyboards of how you begin in one area and you move the camera to give the audience some more information.
And just real quick, you're drawing these full boards so that you can send them to the editor who's going to do the camera moves for the animatic, yeah?
That's right. The editor is a chap. We've worked together on all three projects now, starting with Grand Budapest, and he's called Edward Birch. And he's a sort of After Effects genius. Somehow we're able to supply him with these with this artwork and with the animation poses, and he starts to edit this thing. And it slowly builds from there. So again, with the Japanese woodblock prints, you can see the almost camera moving left and right. So that was fun. And I include these really just as an example of, say, how you can take the subject matter of your film and somehow start to impose it on the actual work, and that will somehow let you get closer to that zeitgeist of, in this instance, you know, Japanese cinema.
And how did it work was it a back and forth with Wes a little bit, you know?
A lot of back and forth.
Yeah, okay. And so
for sure.
You bring him something, you talk about something. And what were the things that floated to the top for you?
Well, his scripts are very detailed and prepared and almost like a little novel. And so the procedure that we go through, because I was on Isle of Dogs for 2 years, so that's, you know, the film only lasts for, I'm not even sure, but it doesn't last for 2 years. But what we do over that process is we make, you know, a few versions of the film, and you're always trying to find the best version of a shot, of a scene. And so that's where the time is spent. And when Wes has time, he's able to thumbnail. When he doesn't, there's shot lists that, you know, that I then sketch up and he reacts to. And, you know, you just sort of go from there, really.
Yeah, and we're not seeing it here, but I remember from before that Wes, in his detailed descriptions, also had his own little thumbnails, you know, so...
Yeah, he's always done, going all the way back to Rushmore, I think he's always thumbnailed on the script, and that's a very sort of... He's of that school of filmmakers, the Hitchcocks, the Spielbergs, and the Kurosawas that did use that tool as a way to, like you say, communicate ideas, really. You know, which brings us nicely into Kurosawa, because he storyboarded and he had storyboarders, and it was really a way of you know, getting to some of those images that, like I was saying to Andrew, some of these Kurosawa films have lasted generations. And some of these images, you know, the fact that we're still talking about them tonight, it's interesting that his process, you know, began with sketching. And I think he wanted to be a painter when he was younger. So this is an early film called The Men Who Tread on the Tiger's Tail. And I'll just play a little clip and then I'll talk about how it kind of fed into the frame. He sort of constructs a lot of these shots. So this is a sort of example from a shot from Isle of Dogs where you have that very extreme foreground layering with the detail. And what's interesting, it really starts to make you think about the depth of the shot. Yeah. And I always think anytime you can storyboard and almost want to climb into the storyboard in a way and get in there and go find out what's going on in that robot dog's head. But you really want to sort of draw the audience in. So again, another example of this sort of extreme layering that we brought in. But yeah, as I mentioned, Kurosawa did his own storyboards, and in fact did a lot of them with color. And this is a quote, him explaining it was a way for him to clearly grasp the visual image that he was after. Storyboard is interesting because it brings us onto this idea of how you would use nature in the shot. He would often do this because there wouldn't be very much going on in the actual shot itself. The character would be very still, and he would use like wind and sounds, and you know, the grass and the trees would blow, and it was a way of sort of introducing movement into a static frame. So Andrew, we can talk a little bit about the blocking of characters and stuff. And there's a few things I can move through quite quickly, and then maybe if there's questions at the end, we can always circle back to.
Right. Okay.
But the one thing that I did do is watch a lot of films such as The Bad Sleep World. I don't know if you guys have seen that. And the way that I often work is that if I can and if I have the time is, you know, really study, look at these films, look at scenes. In this particular case, look at how Kurosawa was dealing with large groups of characters in shot. Because it's very easy for a shot to suddenly become quite messy and disorganized, and that wasn't the way that Kurosawa worked. You know, it worked in a very sort of specific way. So it's interesting to sort of look at how he stages large groups, and the same way that Wes approaches it is that it's very choreographed and everybody hits their mark.
And you've done some nice work in your presentation also about character, the development of character that you also... in your work as a storyboard with Wes, helping develop the characters, you know, so from an early stage.
Sure. I mean, if we can get back to some images.
Oh, yeah. Can we go back to the laptop?
Super. So I can talk about that in terms of the movement of the camera, because it's really the characters that should dictate that, you know, but you shouldn't just kind of move the camera willy-nilly. It should be somehow tied into the sort of emotions of the character. So one shot I remember really being quite fond of is the birth of the puppies towards the end of the film. And again, sort of tying it back to Kurosawa, and it's interesting, Nikki, that you're quite limited with your cuts, aren't you? You often do long takes, very long takes, in fact. And it's a very sort of, a great, fantastic old Hollywood tradition, and Kurosawa was very much a believer in that every shot in a way should have a beginning, a middle, and an end. and that it's, you know, telling a story. So, yeah, as you say, Andrew, a lot of the character designs are sort of they're beginning, but they're not quite there, and the animatic is also beginning. So sometimes you have a period of time where you're just sketching what the characters might be, and you have that feedback from Wes, and he decides and evolves, and, you know, maybe take that nose from that dog and put it on that, you know, character and stuff. But so here we see the birth of the puppy, and we see Atari coming in. So the beginning of the shot is really all about the puppies. And then you have the middle, which is much more about Atari and the caring side of his nature. And again, that kind of interaction between Spots and Atari. And then you have the section of the shot where the curtains start to blow in the wind, and you reveal in the deep, deep, deep background Chief at the tiller of the ship. And then these are storyboards in order to be able to get us to that point of moving the camera through past Atari and Chief. And so, as I say, developing all the sea and the stars and all the different dogs, and just putting all this mixture together that Wes wants into this big soup, and making these camera moves. But I did think that for me was a real, it's always a, and again, this is a learning process, you're always learning, but that whole idea of a shot having a beginning, a middle, and an end, and somehow having, helping the transition to the next shot, I just find fascinating. Then finally, I hope by now you've spotted the key word in all of these elements of movement, and just the fact that, you know, they call them motion pictures for a reason, and you know, that is the thing that we sort of took away from Kurosawa, myself especially, is this sense of movement and motion. So this final point is just to really discuss the idea that you can have movement in the cut. And as you all know, this idea of cutting on the action of something in a wide and then cutting in close on the same action just helps make an invisible cut. And I always think that every time you make that cut, you're asking the audience to make a big leap with you. And so if you can help them on that journey, even the word cut is very violent. So it's fun to see how Kurosawa does that. So yes, this, just to tie that back into Isle of Dogs, there's a scene at the beginning where Chief is introducing all the pack, and there's this very rapid cut through all the different dog tags. And so yeah, this is a very fascinating thing that you can build that tempo in a film. You can have calm moments, and then you can have very, very tense moments.
I mean, figuring out the timing, it gives Wes this opportunity to really figure out exactly. I mean, and I think maybe you'd said this before, he had learned a lot of lessons on Fantastic Mr. Fox, and so he stepped up his storyboarding and the animatics for Isle of Dogs. Is that right?
Yeah, they used it on Grand Budapest, which, I mean, you do storyboarding live action, but it's rare that you make animatics. And French Dispatch, which is out in a few months' time, there's a whole animatic for that. And that's just his procedure, that it's his chance to really sort of design the film in his own head before you get the pressures, as I'm sure you know, Nikki, of reality and budgets and teams of people and stuff. It's Wes's vision, Wes's project, Wes drives it, obviously works on the script in much detail. And in the first film, Grand Budapest, had able to spend a lot of time, you know, thumbnailing. So it was really just helping take those thumbnails, make them much more detailed and animated. And then through Isle of Dogs, obviously that was a longer project, much more animatic was needed. And so when he couldn't thumbnail, then I would thumbnail and then suggest, he would react. Quite often what he does is takes a bit of an image and moves it around and move that there. And so it's very sort of back and forth. But really, you know, he wants you to contribute, certainly, as all the members of the team. You're not just supposed to sit there passive. You're supposed to help and contribute and make the process work smoothly. But it's certainly Wes's vision. I'm there to help that onto paper and into the edit. And so you certainly can make suggestions, but he's the boss.
On the Isle of Dogs, you showed like the storyboard, and it had like a painting, a whole painting. So you do the painting, or Wes is more responsible, like he says what's in the world, or you just suggest and create it? Like the whole, you know, camera work, you can see the frame, just only part of it. So yeah. So Wes Oldway also creates the worlds by itself, like all the details?
Well, he has, I mean, again, it's really, he's exploring. That's what the whole, you know, we don't make these animatics sort of for the sake of it. It's a process that he's exploring. You have the production designer who's involved. He's starting a whole area of development and research, and it's all feeding in to the storyboard. And I believe every shot, the way he works now, is every shot that we animate, make an animatic of, is also made as a piece of concept art. So that's a whole other area that I'm not involved in. The production designer and the concept artists work up every shot. And really, Wes's process is, I always think of him as an additive director. You know, he's constantly adding detail all the way through the process. You know, I believe right into editing and post-production, he's constantly adding these details in. So as a storyboarder, you do what you can and you try and contribute, but it's certainly fun.
In a digital age dominated by special effects and a fix-it-in-the-post mentality, Simon Weiss's models stand out. A Berlin-based miniature maker, modeler, and prop maker, Simon here talks about scaling his work to the whimsical world of Wes Anderson's Grand Budapest Hotel, as well as the challenges behind combining practical and special effects, a hallmark of Anderson's filmmaking.
So we had this drawing by one of the favorite painters and from Wes Anderson. He's called Carl Sprague. And the only thing we had to start on these miniatures was this drawing and a really existing hotel, which is in Karlsbad, Karlovy Vary in Czechia. But we had no specific drawings or plans. They just gave us this drawing, some references here, and our end result as a miniature was this. Here you can see the size. This is Alex, by the way, who did also this this model there. It was about 4 meters wide, and the funny thing, while we have built it, the art department came up with some information, and they said, okay, we sent you two color references, two pinks. And when we got the color references, I said, oh no, we can't use these colors. It's awful. And in the end, you paint it and you watch a bit in different towns. You have houses and hotels with this kind of color. So we had a visit from Wes. He just came to see us once in this film because he's very discreet and he respects our work, but we have a kind of freedom to do it.
I'm curious. When he walks in, I can imagine it's like a kid walking into a candy store. It made there's a new toy. How is it? What was his reaction when he got to see this thing that had been in his imagination, but now it's in front of him?
Yeah, it's on one side. It's like a kid, and he's playing with stuff. But on the other side, it has to be very professional. So we are speaking about very specific things, how it has to be in the film afterwards. For example, this, he didn't want to shoot this in a studio. That's why we went outside. He wanted to shoot this in natural light. That is a very important thing for him. We were lucky because it was not raining or snowing. Then we had other models to do for this film, like this observatory. We just had this drawing and a reference from an observatory in Switzerland. That's the drawing, and that is our model be built in something like 12th scale. And here you can see the details we have on the model, like these rocks, because when people are talking about model making, a lot of people think it's playing with railways, but we do something else. It goes much further. We have to even with the paint on these, we have to be very detailed and respect the right scale of the model.
Just two quick questions on that. Is there such thing as too much detail in your work?
Sometimes, because my model make, they tend to work every detail, and you don't see it on camera. They will work the behind the back of this model, but we don't need it. But they're so passionate, so. Mm. I think you can't go. You always have to go very far, really very far, to make it believable.
Yes, and just because I know you're talking about scale, is there anything that, you know, for any of us who are not working in this world of miniatures, how is scale constantly changing, and how is it used for film?
I would say that now, with the techniques today, we have to build as big as possible. Mm-hmm. In the 50s or 60s, we had small scales, and when you watch on some films, you say, no, okay, that looks strange, and because they were working with scales like 40th or 50th. Now this one is a 12th scale, and when you have some elements, real elements combined to this, like fire, water, smoke, if the miniature is too small, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So this is the final result. They have shot these mountains somewhere in Switzerland, just plates, and then our model was combined in. The thing is with Wes is that he goes as far as he can with practical effects. So before he says, okay, we have no other solution than doing some CGI with visual effects. We try to build everything in miniature and practical effects, and then. But in the end, you have to combine and to composite these kind of pictures.
Can you talk? I mean, as you're going through this, the choice that was made to use miniatures models. Instead of CGI, as an artistic choice that Wes made, and I'm curious about the freedom that it gave you when it doesn't have to necessarily blend seamlessly into the other live action, but it is its own.
It's because, okay, Wes is very special, but you have also other directors who now come back to this kind of miniature sets. I think it's because you can do nearly everything now with CGI, and even when I show this to people who are working only with CGI, they sometimes don't understand. They say, why are you building miniatures? It's so easy to do this on a computer. And I say, yeah, but we have a kind of imperfection and mistakes sometimes in our miniatures. And it's just, as you said, an artistic choice to do it like that. I had a lot of discussions with other directors. They wanted to do miniatures, but then the producer comes and said it's too expensive. In the end, it's not so expensive, and even CGI is expensive. So, as you said, it's an artistic choice, and Wes trusts us as model makers that the ideas he has will be done as he wishes it. Okay, that's it for Grand Budapest Hotel. And we jump to Isle of Dogs, which is totally different because we had a live action film before with some miniature sets. Isle of Dogs is a puppet animation film. And it's so different because it's 4 years' work. We worked about 2 years on this, but you know, you have to write a script first, then storyboarding, then the first thing is voices. All the voices of the actors are done before everything. It's a totally different work. I worked on another stop-motion film before, but a very small one, and this one, it was, however, a bit the first time for me and a new challenge, but a very interesting challenge. The thing is, it was shot in London in 3 Miles Studios, and they had a big crew of set builders and model makers there, building miniature sets for the animators, for puppets who are about a scale of sixth scale or seventh scale. It's like a Barbie doll, more or less. So they have built about 200 sets in London, and they asked me to set up a crew here to make different models. All the miniature sets with landscapes, cities in a much smaller scale, where on these sets we had no animation or some very easy animation. It's not the same work. We're not working in the same scale. It was two different workshops. And the most important we did on this was the famous Megazaki City. And here we go again with a drawing done by Carl Sprague. That's more or less all we had to do this set. We had this drawing and a lot of references from buildings from Japan, like villages. And most of the time we had these skyscrapers in brutal concrete from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So it was interesting because we had to do our own research for all this. And in the end, we had the result of this.
Megazaki was a city of the future, but it was done in this style from the.
It was done in the style of the whole film. You know, it's. It was always, Wes said always, it's in the style of the 60s and 70s, but in the future. So do something with that. and then you have, for example, we made this this old town in the front. And we, in the beginning, we had it really like an old town. And he said, "No, it looks too old. It has to be an old town, like when you go in the city, and there are plenty of tourists having a look at it, like it was before."
Right.
So I show you some technical things how we did it. As we had no ground plan and no from the art department, we had to set it up ourselves. There was a ground plan, but talking about mistakes, it didn't work. The ground plan didn't work. So I decided to make volumes in polystyrene, to put this in front of camera and to see how it works. So we could move the different buildings, and for example, the old town in front is a scale about 30, 35. Then you go further back with the other buildings, about 50 scale, and we end up in a 100, 200 scale in the background. So little by little, we have built all these buildings, about 150.
And is there anybody checking in with you at this point as you're figuring these, you know, you work through the mistake, yeah, and now you're trying to you're figuring this out?
What I do is nearly every day I make pictures of this and I send it to the art department and Wes and production, so they know what we're doing, not drinking coffee all the time, but we're doing something. And yeah, and that's the process. And in the process, sometimes it happens, they say, "Oh no, this doesn't work, so we have to change." But it's also difficult. They were in London, we were here in Berlin, so communication is difficult. Even with the internet and everything, it's a different thing when you see somebody. in front of you talking about things than always explaining through emails and stuff. All these buildings we did were reused in other scenes in the film. Because this scene, I mean, it's about 2 seconds. You see, it's 2 seconds beginning and then it disappears. But then they took all the buildings to have them always in the background. So the big thing with Wes is that normally we would take some pictures of the buildings and just Photoshop it and that's it. No, we had a camera move on this. So when a building disappeared on one side, he took the building and just put it on the other side. So it's a way of doing it.
Hi, I'm Marcella, also in production design. And I'm curious because, you know, we heard a lot from cinematographer and it sounds like the collaboration is direct between you and Wes Anderson in both films. But I'm curious how active the dialogue was between you and the production designer and how much of the collaboration was between you two as opposed to you and Wes Anderson. I mean, you know, usually they have this like clear hierarchy, but it sounds often that it was between you and Wes direct as opposed to you and the production designer.
Yes, I must say that the Wes Anderson films is not like all the other films. You have direct contact with him. I worked on other films where you never meet even the director. It's just the art department. And you don't meet the production designer, you just meet, as you say, in the hierarchy, people, assistants. And all his films are different. In first place, I handle with the production designer on Isle of Dogs and Grand Budapest Hotel. It's Adam Stockhausen. He's really fantastic, and we have quite a friendly approach now and a confidence each other. But in the end, it's always Wes who decided what he wants. Even Adam is asking Wes, we are not sure about this, and Wes will give the final answer. But it's not like this in every film.
Chicken Run, Wallace and Gromit, and Grand Budapest Hotel are among Tristan Oliver's credits as an animation cinematographer. A long-standing collaborator of Wes Anderson, Tristan here talks about the differences between preparing Fantastic Mr. Fox and Isle of Dogs, and his work on set, creating moods for a director who knows exactly what he wants. A particularly challenging endeavor when a scene involving 50 lighting experts is meant to look as though it was set up by a single hand.
Today we have some material that we want to jump into. Fantastic Mr. Fox. And before we do that, I just, maybe you can also say an introduction to how you got into that project, you know, how you went from where you were doing some films with Aardman Entertainment and then moving in towards your working relationship with Wes Anderson.
Yes, well, I mean, it was a peculiar process, actually. I left Aardman after Curse of the Were-Rabbit, and I heard that Fox was shooting in London, and I went to see the producer and showed them my reel, and eventually, you know, Wes saw my reel, and I got the job. And what I didn't know at the time was that they had actually already got a DP for that movie.
Oh, wow.
And I had no idea. And they then, you know, that guy got the boot. And then, you know, we moved into this process of working with Wes. But what you have to understand is that at that point, Wes Anderson had never worked in stop frame, and we had never worked with Wes Anderson. And so that first movie was a process of getting to know each other and getting to know how he works. So it was a huge learning curve for us, and was on occasion very difficult, I think, for both him and for us, you know, trying to find a language and a way of working to get, you know, that very exact vision that he has onto the screen. We got through it. And then, you know, when Isle of Dogs came along, we already had that language, we already had that relationship, and it was a very different kind of production. But what Fantastic Mr. Fox is really is a learning curve.
Did you know Wes's work before going into Cold Calling in on this?
Yeah, I mean, I knew it a little bit. I mean, I knew Bottle Rocket and I knew Rushmore. But I didn't I didn't really know it. No, by that point, he didn't have a sufficient body of work for people to be able to pronounce something like Wes Anderson. You know, I mean, he was still kind of building his catalog at that point. But yeah, I mean, you know, going back to what I said about Wrong Trousers, the great thing about Fantastic Mr. Fox is that, you know, he wouldn't let us do any of the new stuff in it. You know, everything had to be done to camera, you know, so things that we'd kind of long ago got rid of, you know, like making flames and smoke and things like that. I mean, you know, we were shooting live action elements or we were making them in CG, but he wanted everything made in front of the camera. So it was, it was pretty kind of hardcore back to your roots filmmaking in that instance.
That's great. And normally, how does it work? When you go as a DP, as a cinematographer, a project, how does it work when you go to a director, and then how does it work differently when working with Wes, let's say?
Okay, well, I mean, it's, you know, the director is the guy or the woman who has the vision, you know, so you're always paying, you're a servant to that process, if you like, yourself and the production design. Typically, I would put together a mood board, some clips, some stills, and I would sit with the director and offer images up and say, you know, I was thinking about this for this sequence or this for this sequence, you know, what do you think? And we would sort of come to a place where we kind of knew what the film was going to look like. With Wes, that's very much predetermined. You know, Wes knows exactly what he wants the film to look like in his head. And so as a cinematographer, your job is to get it out of his head and onto the screen. And the collaboration in terms of how is it going to look, mm-hmm. is a much smaller part of it, but the collaboration is him trusting you to have the skill set to get the image right and get it up there, and he's very, very exacting. He knows within his own style what works and what doesn't work. So you know, there's no corner cutting. There's no chance of him going, yeah, okay, that'll do. Because it won't do, it has to be absolutely right. And, you know, we can work on some sequences for a very, very long time, just sort of finding that path to what makes it right and makes it coherent, you know, because it is a very precise feel that you're working towards.
So, and tell me, with Fantastic Mr. Fox, you talked about being at Aardman on Wrong Trousers and some of these other films with six or seven people in a small space. Now, what are we looking at? You know, because still, I think people, and even myself, you imagine it as a small little world with, you know, elves coming around and moving things around. But talk about the scale and scope of this.
Well, we had already gone big at Aardman. I mean, we went big for Chicken Run and Curse the Rabbit. And so, you know, a typical modern day stop frame animation stage contains about 50 shooting units. So you're looking at 50 sets, 50 cameras, and 50 animators probably working away simultaneously to get this film made. Because, you know, animation takes a long time. I think there's a feeling that it's slow, but actually it's not slow. It just takes a long time. Everyone's going as fast as they possibly can. And to service that size of stage, you know, the entire crew is about 300 people. And wow. That encompasses, you know, construction, puppet making, wig making, cinematography, editing, VFX, you know, all under the same roof.
Yeah.
But with a lot of real estate. You know, my crew do typically 10 to 15 kilometers a day around the stages. So it's a big, busy environment.
Okay, wow. And so if, as it is your job to communicate the vision to the rest of your crew, I mean, so you have lighting and working with all these different departments, as your role as the DP, I'm going to click through some of your pictures here. But if you could talk about how you manage this, I think you told me at one point this idea that one hand makes it. You know, is that, or can you talk about this concept?
I mean, when I have a stage of that size, you know, I typically light myself with my gaffer maybe 15, 16 of those sets. But I can't do 50. I haven't got the bandwidth to do 50. So I have a couple of other guys who light for me. But, you know, as you say, it has to look like one hand made it, and that hand is my hand. So although those guys are very talented and given half a chance would go off and do something fantastic of their own, it has to look like it's my fantastic stuff, not their fantastic stuff. So I give very, you know, very strict notes about what I want it to look like, and they shoot tests, and we watch the tests projected, and I give them notes so that the film feels coherent.
Right.
Because we're not shooting in sequence, you know, we're shooting out of sequence, and I in my head, I know what I want the film to look like, and I quite often make charts which have got a color palette or a mood palette or a time of day palette, so I can pull up any sequence in pre-production and I know what time of day it is, I know what the emotional point of the story arc is at that point, so I can, you know, I can give quite detailed notes about what I want stuff to look like. You know, sometimes even just a simple thing like where the sun is, and how high the sun is in the sky, or in a lot of Wes films, no sun in the sky, you know, just very flat, cloudy light,
Being ready to share it and knowing where you're at any given point of time when they come to you.
Exactly. And that also goes with the art department as well. You know, so I have a very close relationship with the art department, because obviously what they build is what we shoot. And this is the guys making the sewer tunnel for the.
Right. You're working with them all along the way, even from the designs at the beginning.
From day one and every day, you know, they call me into the art department and they go, well, how about this? And we'll talk about color and we'll talk about texture and, you know, maybe something has been made too shiny or the color won't work on camera, you know. So we're constantly testing and also photographing stuff to make sure that it survives when you project it. Because if you've got something really tiny, you know, I did a movie with a mobile phone in it that was about this big, but there was a full frame of the mobile phone. So when it's projected, of course, it's 15 meters high.
Right.
So, you know, it needs to bear scrutiny at that kind of magnification. So quite often props go back for another go if they're not quite perfect enough.
And can you talk about your relationship when you're working with so you have the props, you have the animators, the puppeteers that are working. And how's that communication going as you're moving along through?
Yeah, it's a sort of rolling process. So, if you imagine just like an empty stage, and then the set comes in and the set dressers come in, and whilst they're dressing the set, we light around them. So they're putting in all the paint finishes and the props and things like that.
Right.
And so we have that communication at that point. And if there's anything serious, you know, it could be that something needs completely chopping off and rebuilding, just because when you get it in front of the camera, it's not quite what you expected when you saw it in the workshop. So we have that continuing dialogue, and then the set is brought to a point of readiness. So it's lit, the motion control is sorted out, any DMX lighting changes are sorted out. Then the animator comes in, and we talk to the animator about, you know, where the action is within the frame, and if there's any motion control with the camera moving with the puppet, then the motion control operator has that conversation with the animator, and they work together so that the camera doesn't lose track of the puppet or the puppet doesn't lose track of the camera. So everything sort of fits together organically and looks real. And again, you know, this constant thing I keep saying, that the process doesn't get in the way of the story. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not aware that the camera's moving robotically, and you're not aware that the characters are actually being manipulated by an animator, you know, they're just a dog, you know?
So you talked about Fantastic Mr. Fox being a learning curve. So when you started to, when you knew you'd be working again with Wes on Isle of Dogs, what did you want to do differently? I mean, what did you learn? What did you want to do differently? How did you prepare? And can you give us a sense of what is your pre-production process like?
Well, I mean, Wes rang me and asked me to do the job. And, you know, that was enough, really. He sent me the script and he sent me the first 12 minutes of the animatic. If anyone out there doesn't know what an animatic is, it's basically a storyboard that has been shot to length. So it's a sort of, it's a rough 2D version of the movie that's been timed out with the voice track on it. So you get a rough idea of what the film looks like. So he came to me, and he came to several of us who had worked on Fantastic Mr. Fox, because, as I said, you know, this long, painful process of Fox had resulted joyfully in this complete mutual trust. So, you know, we made it to the end, and then he knew we could do it. So that whole kind of learning process of him for us and us for him wasn't there anymore. So we had a much more open dialogue with him. And it was a, you know, it was a much more relaxed production from that point of view.
Nice.
And because there were no, you know, nothing he could do would surprise us or shock us, you know, because we were entirely ready for it. So
right.
It just became, how do we do this? You know, which is a great place to be, because challenges are actually quite fun.
Mm.
And, you know, he likes to push the boundaries. I mean, even with animation, there are problems with shooting animation, because everything's so small. You know, it's there are many, many issues with the photography and with the scale that make it very hard. But he wants to take it a step further. You know, he wants his stop frame movies to have the same feel as his live action movies. So, you know, working with very wide lenses and very deep focus, which is super hard in animation. So.
Right.
You know, sometimes I would say to him, you know, actually, physics tells us that we can't do this. And he always says, just show me what you can do.
Yeah, okay.
And we'll see whether we can just push it a little bit further and break physics.
Seeing the world through Wes Anderson's films triggers a childlike feeling of wonderment. Yet the ingenuity and skill of the craftsman we've heard from is what provides his films with such playfulness. If you want to hear from a range of other engaging filmmakers we've had the chance to talk to over the years, subscribe to our channel and visit our website at berlinale-talents.de, where you can also find today's talks in full. This podcast is brought to you in cooperation with Goethe Institute. It is produced by 4000 Hertz, our editor is Vincent Forster, music is by Rutger Reiners, and project management is by Christine Trostrum and Florian Weghorn. And it was presented by me, Hannah Serene. Thank you for listening.